Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you once again. As I think I pretty well always say when I am here, this is kind of like homecoming. This is the very first church I came to when I was a young university student with the prospect of being posted by the RCMP out to Vancouver, a terrifying prospect at the time. And I remember visiting here on that trip, on that first week that was to set the course of my life in many more ways than one. So it's a joy to be among you. It's a joy to be among some of you, too, that have been to Cambodia and have seen some of the things that we do. But this morning, rather than speak too much about the actual ministry in Cambodia, it's really appropriate we spend time with the Lord and seeing what He has to say to us about how we live and about how He challenges us in terms of how we live. And so I've chosen this passage, which has become a very meaningful one to me in a multiplicity of ways that we'll get into in just a moment. Okay, so some years ago, I had a conversation with a young woman. I'll call her Jenny. And she was in Ontario. And she was born into a non-Christian family. She herself was the only Christian in her family, a keen Christian, but it was difficult for her. Her journey started off in a very difficult way. Her family did not want her, and so they attempted two abortions that failed. And she was born with health issues, but born to grow up to know the Lord. What an amazing thing that is. And she sought to seek and witness to her Lord within the family that tried to erase her. She was prone to sickness based on the trauma that occurred to her as a result of the attempted abortions. And she heard about what we were doing in Ratnak, and she wanted to help, but she was fearful because going to Cambodia, she had particular skills. Those of you who have been with us know it's difficult to actually plug people into our programs in Cambodia because of the skill sets required, working in criminal environments in Cambodia with some very, very difficult human trafficking issues. But she really wanted to help, and she had some particular skills we needed, and so I was really keen for her to go over short term. But she was very reluctant because for you and I, if we get sick, it's not necessarily a big problem. For her, it would have been a very big problem. What about the food? What about food poisoning? What about illness? What about dysentery? What about malaria? What about all these things? And so she worried, and she really wanted to help, but she didn't know what to do with the reality she was faced with and the risks that were associated with that. And so we discussed at length the obstacles that were very real that would be in her way, and the risks that would be very real as we work with youth in Cambodia in mafia, criminal-controlled areas where young people are bought and sold and trafficked, where the lives are hopeless, and there's really no expectation of changing that environment or changing those people. In so many ways, we have been faced with an impossible task. From a medical standpoint, it's disastrous. From a psychological standpoint, it is disastrous. From a spiritual standpoint, it is worse than disastrous to work in a community and communities where people are bought and sold as product. Very, very difficult. And yet, it is into such unwinnable circumstances that we are called if we are people of faith. It is precisely into those circumstances that we are urged by God to engage, that we are actually qualified to engage where the secular community are not qualified because they simply don't have God on their side. And so it is into the realm of impossibility that I have grown somewhat accustomed to and used to. To do this, I left a very solid career with good expectations of pension. And I, in fear and trembling, moved out into the charity world, not a very stable world. And I can honestly tell you that I have not suffered one bit. I wouldn't change a thing. The kids are in a better school than they were before. We've been able to pay the bills, and we have not suffered at all. God has taken care of us. And that's wonderful, but it is not necessarily representative of what happens when we go into ministry. There are challenges, and we're fools, I believe, if we adhere to prosperity gospel and, well, we serve God and everything turns out right. Sometimes things can get really rough. And that's one of the things I navigated with Jenny. There are no guarantees. You might get really sick. What are we going to do with that? In what context do we do we look at such risk in our own lives? I think if we look at our own lives and we look at Scripture, it is very clear that no matter what the circumstances, faith dictates we act. We act for God in the circumstances that surround us. As people of faith, we are called to those that are hopeless. We are called to hopeless circumstances. We are called to the unwinnable fight. We are called to tackle the insurmountable problem. We are called to act despite every good common sense you have. We are called to act despite our fear. And I would submit to you that if we do not have fear and we are not confronted with stuff that scares us, that we kind of like to engage with, but we're too scared to do it, you're not really in touch with where you should be spiritually. We need to be a little scared of what God puts in front of us. In that context, are you exceptional? Am I exceptional? Are we exceptional in our bravery? No. Are we exceptional in our maturity? No. Are we extraordinarily talented? No. But nonetheless, we are asked to act. We are asked to act on a greater reality. What is that greater reality? And that brings me to the passage, 2 Kings 6, and I'm going to be speaking on the verses, a small section of verses within what was read, 13 to 17. The context here is the king of the Syrians, the king of Aram, is fighting with the king of Israel, and every time he turns around, the Israelites are sort of one step ahead. I mean, it's infuriating. This is a powerful man, and he is enraged that every move he makes, he seems to have been preempted. And so he asks in verse 11, tell me, which of us is on the side of the king of Israel? Now, let's put this in context. This is a king who, this is old school. This is not modern democracy. This is a king who has the power of life and death over everyone, including his subjects in the room, his leaders. And when he asked that question, imagine being in that room. That's actually an accusation. Who among you standing here right now is on the side of the enemy? Like, this is stuff out of movies in terms of fear. And there's a response that comes. None of us, my lord, the king, said one of the officers. Now, there's a brave man, even to verbalize this. But Elisha, the prophet of Israel, tells the king, what you're doing, no, he's much more specific. Imagine saying this, the risk he takes, how he was shaking as he said this. He tells the king of Israel, the words you speak in your bedroom. He's saying you're trumped. And so the context that absolutely infuriates the king is actually a context already where we see God is completely in control. He laughs at those who think they are powerful. He's way ahead of the game. And so, although he wouldn't attribute it to this, the king of Aram, the king of the Syrians, is absolutely frustrated and angry with the control God has. That's what's going on here. So the context is made clear right from the get-go. It is God's power. The king's response, go to Elisha. So verse 13, they send an army. This is a huge, great, powerful army that surrounds the city, and they are going to get this guy. And it isn't going to be pretty when they capture them. And so the servant wakes up that morning. Now the interesting thing is, once the command is given to go get Elisha, because the two main players here has been Elisha and the king of the Syrians, but as soon as the army is sent, the focus of the passage shifts. It shifts quite dramatically to a servant. It shifts to the little guy. It shifts to the weak one, the junior partner, the one without faith, the one who is without skill. This should be an encouragement for us. I think he's far more representative of us than Elisha is. And so this little one, if you will, gets up and he sees this army. And he is absolutely, appropriately terrified. And he says, oh my Lord, what shall we do? Now, there's numerous times in Scripture where the biblical writers are masters of understatement. This is one of them. You have just woken up. You've sort of stepped out of wherever you're staying, rubbing the sleep from your eyes, and you see this army, and you know very well that's not your army, and you know what they've come for. And this is not fear of being shamed or embarrassed, arrested, put in the back of the police car with all your neighbors watching. That's trivial, although we would find that fairly traumatic. These guys have come, again, old school. They are going to kill, maim, torture, kill. What an awesome spectacle to get up and see this. This is reality in his face. It is terrifying. And so very naturally, he turns to his master. He turns to Elisha, the great man of God, in this question. Oh Lord, what shall we do? And Elisha responds, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid, because I have a place to hide. No. Don't be afraid because I've got an escape plan. No. Don't be afraid because I can apply my intellect to this situation and negotiate my way out of it. No. Don't be afraid because I have weapons and we can fight back. No. He just says, don't be afraid. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. This represents a complete break with reality. Elisha is nuts. He's not getting it. They're surrounded by an army that is physical, that is powerful, that is an army, as far as they're concerned, of death and destruction and torture. And Elisha says, nah, don't worry about it. There's more with us. Are you nuts? Are you insane? What is the servant to do with that answer? It is completely in denial of everything that servant sees. Everything that the senses God has given this servant tell him the opposite. But Elisha goes on. He doesn't say, prove your power, Lord, smite the Syrians and show my servant by destroying them. Nor does he say, Lord, show us the escape route and show us a path out that we can pop up someplace else in some miraculous way. He simply goes on and says, Lord, open his eyes. The simplicity of these prayers and the faith required is very, very challenging stuff. And so the Lord answers that prayer, and the servant's eyes are opened. And what does he see? He sees the hills, the mountain, full of horses and chariots of fire. The way this is structured, it's very clear. It's full. Some translations say the hills, plural. It implies a great expanse. There's not a couple of horses and chariots here. There is a massive, massive army with chariots, armed. Just imagine this. Imagine having your eyes opened and seeing beyond the large army of the Syrians, the hills around, surrounded. Imagine the shifting of the horses' hooves. Imagine the thunder as they move rapidly. Imagine the rattling of armor. Imagine the squeaking of all the leather saddlery. Imagine this spectacle, the whole mountain's reverberating with this movement of this massive army. And we're inclined to say, yeah, guys and horses, chariots, not very influential. We are used to massive aircraft, massive ships, explosions. We have learned to modify our environment. This predates all that. The servant has never seen anything like this. This is beyond comprehension, an army this size. This is the epitome of power being exhibited for him. And as if that wasn't enough, it says they are horses and chariots of fire. Imagine that. You've seen the Hunger Games? You've seen where they get in their chariot and they wear that, I forget what it is, the dress, the flame, whatever it is, and there's just this sense of power, this gravity, like this is unstoppable. And this is exactly what's being presented here. These are not regular chariots that even if there's 100 of them, you might kill the first two before they get you. You're not going to be able to impact one of them. These are horses and chariots of fire. By definition, unstoppable. They are something other. They are something you cannot cope with. So this is a picture that leaves absolutely no doubt as to who's in charge. This is absolute power, and it is absolutely overwhelming. So, does that change the servant's context? No. The servant continues to be surrounded by the army of the Syrians. What is he to do with that? Is he still potentially going to be killed? Yes. Is the army less real around him, the army that the king of Syria has sent? No. They're still very much there. His reality has not changed, but the context, the power of the Syrian army is eclipsed by the presence of this other untouchable, powerful army. And so do you think, in that context, even though his circumstance hasn't changed, do you think his attitude has changed? Do you think his outlook on the Syrian army is different? I would submit to you that it's probably greatly different, because he has seen something that completely eclipses any power the Syrians have, while not actually changing his circumstances. So often, such faith is required for us to grow. So often, we are required to get to the point where we can understand there is a reality greater than ourselves to deal with the same circumstances we have. Not that God will necessarily change our circumstances and make everything come out right, but that we have a sense there is something far more powerful going on in the background. Our faith so often is based on our ability to understand the unseen reality, the true reality of our circumstances. If we can grasp that reality, that God is absolutely real, he is real in our lives, he is real in this room, he is real in Tawasin, he is real in the Lower Mainland, and he is even real in the workings of the world, depressing though they be these days. If we can have a sense that he is actually, literally, more powerful, more dynamic, unstoppable, in charge no matter what, that should change our perspective. One of my favorite passages, my favorite books, some of you know, is Zephaniah. And there's one beautiful verse in Zephaniah in the context of exile. Do not let your hands hang limp. So much in the world would cause us to just kind of go, oh God, we're done, we're done. I don't know if you've seen people like that. So abused, so tortured, so broke, so whatever. They're just done. They've no more fight left in them, and we are told not to be that way. But that necessitates an understanding of a reality beyond ourselves, beyond our scientific, logical, sensory, materialistic way of viewing the world that we are indoctrinated into every single day. We need to step beyond that. If we can grasp that reality, if we can ask God to give us that sense of reality, we will find ourselves emboldened, empowered, inspired, motivated, even driven to serve him, despite the circumstances, not after waiting for the circumstances to all work out, but despite the circumstances we find ourselves in. So the question is, am I influenced by the unseen? Really, are you? Is coming here and worshiping the Lord and doing your devotions and going to Bible studies, is this lip service, or do we actually get the fact that there's a reality more powerful than ourselves, an army out there that is real, that we can choose to stand up and live? I'll tell you, there's plenty of people in the Middle East right now living with a complete understanding of that army of fire, and they're losing their lives over it, but they have a different context. They understand there's something greater. We have things to learn from those who suffer in this way. Some of you may have heard this story before, but it fits well, so forgive me if you've heard it before. Quite a few years ago, I was asked by a Vietnamese pastor in Cambodia to visit a community where 100% of the children were sold at that time. And he said, I want you to come out and walk down the street. I want you to have a sense of the fact that there's no kids here. As soon as they turn about 7 years old, they're gone. You'll see kids up to 7 years old. After that, they're gone. They're all sold for exploitation in the brothels, etc. And so I agreed. And we drove out in a 4x4, and we parked at the end of this shanty town road, and I got out with him, and he told his driver, go around to the other end of town, and we'll meet you at the far end. We're going to walk through. Well, there's only one reason to be in that community, really, as a white person, and that's to buy a child for exploitation purposes. Or you could be there to perhaps stop it. But if you're there to stop it, it's a mafia-controlled area completely. You better have a SWAT team with you. So I was very much alone with this little pastor, and he was obviously Vietnamese. He fit right in, not so much. So I was very, very nervous about this and realized I've got to walk all the way through here, recognizing that I could get a bullet, a knife, or a club in any one of these doorways. And so I walked down the street fearful, but sort of praying and sort of acknowledging the fact that right now Satan is telling me he owns this turf. He owns every square foot of this place. This is his backyard. But Lord, I'm trying to muster up as much courage as I can to acknowledge the fact that you have died for this place and it all belongs to you, irrespective of everything Satan is communicating very powerfully to me right now. And I imagined, because it helped me, we all need our little psychological crutches, I imagined that outside of every one of these recessed doors in the shantytown, there was this large white soldier. You know the stormtroopers in Star Wars? Kind of looking like that, but with a much more face, kind of like an Oscar. Kind of a combination between an Oscar and a stormtrooper. 9 to 12 foot tall, big sword, white armor, and I imagine this, Lord, you have claimed these houses, you have bought this area with your blood, no matter what Satan's telling me. And I just imagined that, and I went through. Got out the other end, and kind of survived that okay. Went back into Phnom Penh for a meeting, and I sat down with a woman who runs an anti-human trafficking organization, and she had a friend in from England, and she had just been there 2 days or so, and I was talking about this horrendous community I'd just been in, and the lady said, she came down and introduced herself and sat at the table with us and said, where are you talking about? And Helen, my friend, didn't give me a chance to answer. She interrupted and said, oh, remember the place we went out to pray yesterday? Remember the place with the white soldiers? And I said, what did you say? And the hair is the back of my neck. I mean, I'm a Presbyterian. This doesn't come naturally to me at all. I don't dream dreams and see visions. But I said, what did you say? And she said, oh, we went out there and we prayed yesterday. As we prayed, God gave us, thank you, a picture of these large guys in armor, 9 to 12 foot tall, and they're guarding every house, and God's saying he will claim that community. And I'm sitting there kind of going, wow. You know, God not only is gracious enough to provide such a reality, but for Presbyterians like me, who are stupid enough not to realize, he actually provides a person afterwards to say, you actually are dealing with something far more important here that you attributed to some kind of little mental image to encourage you. There's a greater reality here. There have only been a few circumstances in my life, as I look back on that I remembered having seen those soldiers before in the northwest of Cambodia at times of great risk during the Civil War. The question for me is, the somewhat damning question for me, is why don't I see those soldiers? Why don't I see that army more often? Why perhaps don't you see such an army more often? And I would submit to you, it's because I'm not scared enough, and you're not scared enough. I think God reveals himself not for entertainment. He reveals himself when he needs to and when we need it. How often do we put ourselves in circumstances for the Lord where we need that kind of encouragement, where we're that far out of the box and we're that scared? The servant of Elisha absolutely needed that. And so, in that context, God calls us into areas that are difficult. He calls us into the impossible fight. He calls us into situations that we're completely unqualified to deal with no expectation of success. And remarkably, although he is not obligated to in any way, he gives success quite frequently in areas that just leave us stunned if we step outside the box to serve him, if we act on the basis of the unseen reality, not what our senses and our scientific, logical, observable world tells us to do or to respond to. Now, if you're faced with a prospect like that and you're completely untrained and somebody asks you to do something like that, are you going to jump at the chance? Are you going to say, no? Are you going to stand at the burning bush and say, I don't think I've got the skills? If God opens the door, should we be stepping into those areas that terrify us, trusting that His army will take care of this? Because a five-hour agreement like that is absolutely not about good negotiating skills. It is about God's army doing what God will do. Do we live that way? Or are we too scared? This does not have to be great international stuff that terrifies us. It can just be the neighbor that's really difficult for you. It can be the circumstances in your school or your work with the people that drive you nuts. The things that you just, oh Lord, I'm going to have to really step out here, because for me to make myself vulnerable with this person who hates me, the army better be nearby. I need to see that reality. And so this is about day-to-day life as well. The risks are still there. The circumstances do not necessarily change. But are we prepared to see God work? Are we prepared to acknowledge there is a reality? Are we prepared to live that way? Circling right back around to Jenny, in complete fear and trembling, she went to Cambodia. She went to a brothel district under the noses of the mafia in the early days when it was very, very difficult, and she participated in running a vacation Bible school. High risk, not fun, difficult work, in squalor, in filth, and God preserved her, and she did not get ill. And so another box ticked. Okay, I've learned something. I need to trust Him more. And in the conversations with her, I would frequently say, Jenny, look to the hills. Look to the hills. Don't look at the street. The street's too close. The street is going to overwhelm. All the evidence suggests you shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be doing this. This is too difficult. Don't look close. Look to the hills. There is an army there. There is a reality that demands of you obedience. And in that, there is joy. And in that, there is hope. So while surrounded and while overwhelmed, serve the Lord. So for us, are we surrounded? Are we limited by our fears, by our failures, those things close up to us? Are we limited by debt, by relational issues that are tragic or difficult? Are we limited by our own greed, our own sin? Are we limited by all these things? Yes. Is that going to change? Maybe, maybe not. In terms of our ability to witness and serve the Lord and do what He calls us to do, are we fearful of ridicule? Are we fearful of our own lack of skills? Are we limited by our own anger, our own frustration, our own bigotry, our own whatever, all the baggage we have? Are we limited by that? Are we limited by our own sense of loss in life? Are we looking beyond that? All those things that swirl around our lives, and are we looking to the hills? Are we looking to that army of fire that represents something even greater? God of the universe, who loves and adores and knows you by name. Is that how you're acting? I would challenge you to step out and look at that greater reality. Those who are with you are greater than those who are against you. Your circumstances may not change, but look beyond to the hills. There is a greater reality. There is an army. There is a powerful God who loves you. And like the servant of Elisha, you can bet your life on it. I encourage you to do so. Thank you.